Every great film and TV maker began as a red carpet rookie. In this podcast, each episode you'll learn from the inspiring career journey of someone who's grown to the top of the entertainment industry, hearing how they mastered their craft with life lessons you can apply to your own creative career, business, or relationships. My name is Mike Battle, a film crew member turned screenwriter, and I'll be your host. And this is Red Carpet Rookies.
I was 24 years old when we went over to make Schindler's List. I didn't know what I was doing.
I have that still. Everything I do, imposter syndrome.
What I learned from Steven Spielberg is
just keep going.
Push forward, you know, no matter how bad things get.
And then they casted a young guy named Brad Pitt.
Don't think so much.
Don't take no for an answer.
It was my first meeting with David about Fight Club.
The day that Pixar called, I was ready.
I just picked up the phone and made $500,000.
I mean, at the beginning of every job, I kind of think, what if I don't have any ideas?
Dream come true, working on a Bond film.
I was terrified because I thought, well, what if I just screw this right up?
He said, you'll get a script at the end of the week. It was Titanic.
Hello and welcome to Red Carpet Rookies. Today's guest has one of the most varied resumes of anyone in the film and TV business. Having produced everything from mega hit Top Boy to winning a BAFTA for The Last King of Scotland, making documentaries and more, I can't wait to hear his story and learn from his journey to success in the industry. He also has one of the coolest names of any guest I've ever had. My guest is Charles Steele. How are you doing today?
I'm very well, mate. Very well, thank you. Very good.
Has that name helped you, do you think, in the career? I get it sometimes with Mike Battle.
I think it has actually, because when I left school, the first thing I didn't excel at school and I didn't go to university or anything. And I sort of threw myself into what was very popular then was telesales, telephone selling. And with a good kind of public school voice and a strong voice, and everyone, I remember it was on a commission only basis, and it's still been a good standing for my career generally, learning those sales skills. But I remember everyone used to kind of make up names, you know, like Edward Scott or, all strong names. Everyone wanted to have a strong name. And I was like about the only salesman who said, you just can't get a stronger name, just stick to your name. So I Charles Steele, I used my own name, which was great. So in some ways that helped me there. That's about it. Yeah.
Love it. Now, I always ask all of my guests the same first question, Charles, and that is, what did your parents do and did it affect your career choices moving forward?
Well, my father was a career serviceman in the army. He signed up for World War II, when it broke at sort of 18 years old, and was a lieutenant colonel and continued. You know, I was born in a British military hospital in Germany and moved around the world in sort of barracks in my early days. So, and all of my uncles and grandparents steeped in the services in one way or another. So in terms of career, I don't know. I don't think it influenced me. Maybe it sort of pushed me away from going into the services. I had kind of just when I was in my teens, I just wanted to kick against everything. And choices were, coming out of school, the services, maybe possibly the priesthood coming out of a monastery and monastic school or the city. But I didn't, I didn't pursue any of those. So I did my own way. So indirectly, it may have pushed me in a different direction just because it was a different direction. But yeah.
It sounds like maybe you might have been a bit of a rebel teenager compared to some of your peers. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. It just took me a little while to find my groove, put it that way. Yeah. Got in, once I did, I was fine. But a little bit in those days. Yeah.
So you left school at 17. Was that something that your parents were supportive of, or was your military father maybe a bit like, oh, what's going on here, Charles?
No, I think I tried a year after that cramming in London just to try and get some exams. But I threw myself into work. I don't think my parents, it was their ideal where they'd hoped after school I'd step into, but I was quite self-willed then and did my own thing. So, I jumped into, as I mentioned, the world of selling and telesales, which is very popular then, getting on the phone, selling advertising space in magazines and things like that. And on and off, I did that for about 4 or 5 years in my early 20s. Yeah.
Interesting. Did you notice that you had a particular talent for it when you went into that? Because obviously, we'll get onto it obviously later, but producing, there is a lot of selling involved.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, whether I had a talent for it or I learned it quickly, but I did very well in it. And I, you know, it was all sort of, it was very short term, say commission only, what targets you hit that week. But it took me, you know, I moved to New York and started doing it there. Then I moved to San Francisco and started doing it there.
Wow.
I was bouncing around a lot. It gave me an opportunity to, you know, travel a bit. But yeah, it was, and I, you know, I was teaching people and I was kind of a closer. So I would listen to lots of other people's calls. And if they got a good call, I would get on and I would close. So I enjoyed, I think the buzz of selling, I always love that kind of, you know, you get on the phone and somebody's saying, I will never, never buy anything on the phone.
Yeah.
And you're like, great, let's just have a chat. And maybe 30 minutes later, they're buying something. So that's that. I used to love the buzz of that, you know. But yeah,
it all sounds very Glengarry Glen Ross.
It was totally like that boiler room. It was that kind of atmosphere. Yeah, you know, early ages and stuff. It was all of that. But I think in sort of my mid-20s, I kind of just realized it was going nowhere. You know, the money was coming in but going out, and it was just a bit. Yeah, I clearly was not feeling very fulfilled. So I was looking for something else to do. And I had some friends, a couple of friends of mine who were working in the film industry, one as a sort of junior clapper loader and somebody else a junior assistant editor. And they just seemed to be, you know, just, like I didn't really know much about the film industry at all. It was completely new. But I thought, you know, maybe they're kind of maybe something different. And they said, what you need to do is get a job as a runner, which I didn't really understand what the hell that meant, but I just said, okay. And I've always been quite like that, sort of jump in with 2 feet. So I sort of started contacting lots of companies and offering my services for free just to get in the door, and eventually started getting a day's running, 2 days running, a week's running, and, you know, slowly started kind of finding a way, which involved basically making a coffee and getting people's dry cleaning and doing whatever was needed on, you know. I think the highlight was carrying a mobile phone for some producer. I remember I had sort of one of those days when the mobile phones were first out, and it was a huge brick, you know, it was like the size of it. And they were shooting a commercial up in. Yeah, the phone was like that, but the actual, you had to have this box. I mean, a huge battery thing, very heavy. And we were shooting a commercial, or they were shooting a commercial up in the Lake District somewhere. And, you know, my job was to sort of follow the producer carrying this brick up the mountain in case he wanted to make a call. So, yeah, it's a good way to learn. Good way to learn.
I mean, you didn't go into the military, but it sounds like what I've seen in movies where those young soldiers have to run around with the old phone. Similar anyway, wasn't it?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Did you ever have did you always have a creative aspiration in you a little bit? To go from always be closing to independent film is quite a big jump. Was that something that built over time?
I think I didn't. No, I think I didn't. I certainly wasn't aware of it. In my late 20s, I've been doing that for 3 or 4 years, and I wanted to get into films, you know, and I found myself working commercials and corporate videos and sort of feeling like I was going further tangentially away from kind of the movies. I sort of traded my sales skills to try and get myself producing. I said, I can go and sell and go and get you some corporate videos. I can help do that. I'm good at selling. And if I get one in, can I produce? So I think my first producing was a timeshare video for a resort in Marbella, but it was a long way from where I thought I was heading. A friend of mine was applying for film school, and I produced his short film, and he said, you know, we kind of in those days the Coen brothers, you know, working together, and we were best friends, and thought maybe I'll have a go and apply. So I applied for the Royal College of Art for the film postgraduate film producing course, not really intending to go, actually. I went in, you know, I remember turning up at his art college wearing a suit, you know, turning up, and I was full of like, you know, why are you making short films here? You know, I can raise money for a movie. I know how to sell. I'm the best salesman there is. I know how to, you know, I can make it happen. We should be making a feature. I'll do all of that. I want to learn insurance distribution, the hustle. And there was this wonderful tutor, Tim Miller, who I was very lucky with, who ran a producing course. And he kind of, you know, somehow, maybe he saw something in me that I didn't see in myself, but he was like, yeah, he was really good. And he just sort of stopped me and said, anyway, well, actually what happened was I didn't get in. So I got ninth place. They rang me and said, you did really well. Your enthusiasm, your energy is great, but you came in ninth. And so there are only 8 places. And I think that was a moment I really wanted to go. Suddenly I thought, I want to go. I've been told I can't go. I want to go. So I signed up for lots of short film courses in the summer, was plaguing them with letters. And come September, somebody dropped out. And they rang me and said, do you want to take a place? And I'd been working and was earning money then. And suddenly in my late 20s, I was thinking, Christ, I've got to go back to education. And anyway, I took the decision. I jumped in and did it. I got a scholarship from Anglia TV to help. But this tutor was great. You know, I was like all hustle. And he just said, you know what? Stop. We're going to stop. Stop running. Stop trying to hustle. We're going to spend 2 years looking inside you and finding out why you want to make films. And you're going to have a chance effectively to connect creatively and find your own creative hub. And I think nobody had spoken to me like that. Nobody had even given me the time to consider that I might have a creative bone in my body. It was quite remarkable, actually. I was very lucky. And and he kind of stopped me and made me think and sort of, you know, I mean, all of it wasn't quite said in those words, but I can see it now. He was like, you know, you've got all that hustle, but let's just do something else. And so I kind of did that for 2 years and graduated, with a postgraduate MA in film producing. I think it was a little unusual that I didn't have a BA. I hadn't been to university, but I sort of traded my CV was my street smarts and my experience selling and working in, you know, on the floor and in the commercials industry. So I kind of used that as my BA. And I, you know, and then I came out of that and it set up a company immediately with Polly Tapston, so we started a company and started making some short films.
What was running through your mind at 29 there? Because often there's people in their 20s are rushing to progress. I'm sure people that work for you are doing similar things. That's quite a big step to start again. Were you almost like, I don't know, scared, or comparing to your peers who are now probably working in the city, doing well, things like that? How did you feel at the time?
I don't think so. I don't know, really. I mean, I'm conscious of it now, but with other people, but I don't think I ever, I suppose it felt from sort of dropping out of school and not really doing anything, it felt like such an advancement that, I mean, I was less worried about, you know, I'm falling behind. I'm just sort of, and I think my, you know, my parents were super supportive. Took a little while to kind of, when I said I want to get into films. I think when I was working as a runner and I started trying to have a go in my mid-20s, the one thing I did see very quickly was the job that I thought I could do was producing. I thought that's the job I like and I want to do. I can see just, I was drawn to that. And there were big producers like, you know, David Putnam and people like that who were, used to go to their lectures and talks. So they were sort of the hero figures to kind of emulate. But my, you know, once I sort of, yeah, my parents were super supportive once I'd shown that I was serious. It wasn't another just, you know, quite used to kind of coming in with a new idea and a new plan. And it felt like, you know, hey, he's actually giving this a go. So I think once they saw I wanted to do something. So no, I don't think, you know, I think it was just such a, I felt like my 20s, it took a while to fall into the groove. And I think having found a groove, I think everyone was just, and me included, just glad I was doing that, really, rather than thinking, you know, oh my God, you know, where am I in the rat race sort of thing, you know, yeah.
Would you say that there's much of a fake it till you make it element to becoming an independent film producer? Because to go from art school into being, I am the producer, particularly for someone like myself, who's come from quite a large studio production background, you know, working your way up on a very clearly defined ladder, for someone to go out and say, I'm the producer now, I'm going to bring this together. How was that for yourself?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, it is, strangely, producing is just, you know, the minute you call yourself you're a producer, you're a producer. So there is a lot about confidence. Even it's not really sort of trickery. It's just, but you have to believe that you are going to lead the way, and you kind of, you just need to say it. And you know, I mean, many producers don't necessarily produce stuff, or it takes a long time, but they're still producers. So, but I mean, I was lucky with Polly. She was a great partner. She hadn't come out of film school, but we'd come different ways and teamed up. And I both did different jobs then to try and get going. Our office was effectively an A4 file that sort of sat in her kitchen, and we'd meet once a week and sort of talk about it. And I was working, again, I used my selling thing. I went to the commercials industry and I offered to sell repping commercials directors to agencies. I said, I'll go out, I'll take the reels, I'll do what I do. And in return for which, you've got that desk, can Polly and I use it? And that could be we can call it in our minds, that's our company.
Yeah.
And it was like very, very, but it was doing other jobs to pay it and get it going. There was no money coming in. There were some good schemes around in terms of short films, or there were different schemes. The Short and Curly scheme, which was interesting, very, very expensive short films made like a movie, sort of on 35 mil. And I think we did two or three of those over the course of, you know, a few years. They brought in a couple of grand production fee, which was like manna to heaven for us. We could live on that for a long time, supplement it with other work. So it was a lot about just supplementing and getting it going and, yeah, just, you know, running around and, yeah.
Cool. You mentioned Polly there, and one of the key things in the industry generally, but also as a film producer, is relationships and collaboration. And one of the ones I'd love to ask you about is, of course, your collaboration with Ronan Bennett. So how did you first meet Ronan and hear about his idea for Top Boy?
Yep. A few years later, I'd had a new partner, Ali Flynn, with Cowboy Films after a very, you know, jumping 10 years here or so, or 15 years probably. And we were just looking to do some ideas, work more in TV. We'd done a single film, I think Poppy Shakespeare, and we were looking to do more TV. We had a TV deal with Channel 4 and we're looking to grow. They were helping support us. So we were knocking on the doors of writers and we sort of liked Roman's, the muscularity of what Ronan had done in his writing, and sort of approached him and asked to get a meeting and pitched him some ideas about Siege, you know, a thriller, a miniseries on a kidnap, or a, you know, these kind of quite kind of, you know, we thought were kind of good things. And Ronan just batted them all away and was not that interested. And then we got talking and he mentioned Top Boy was his real passion. He, you know, inspired by The Wire, he'd sort of dreamed and he'd done all this research and he thought there was a room in the UK to see something like that about what's happening in London. He'd written he wanted to do it as a big series, but he got a commission from BBC to write a single and he'd written that a few years before and nothing happened with it. And then we said, can we read it? And we read it and thought, wow, this is like amazing. This is great. This is so, we love it. And so we said, can we, you know, put it together and take Channel 4 and try and turn it into a series? And we got a pretty quick commission into a miniseries, four-parter, and then put it together. Yeah. So just knocking on the door thinking we were going to do one thing and then, you know, it goes in a different direction.
When you read those Top Boy scripts, what are they like on the page as opposed to the final product? Because I understand the actors add a lot of their own slang and you've worked with Jerry Jackson on it.
Yeah, I mean, well, they read great. I mean, in terms of the depth of character, the political nuance and the page turning thrills. I mean, Ronan's brilliant at the page turning, you know, absolutely brilliant. And yeah, Jerry is very close collaborator. Jerry provides a lot of stories to Ronan. So in some ways, his bit is before the script. You know, he brings the people and the characters, and so much of Top Boy is all associated with real people or incidents and people Jerry's introduced Ronan to and kind of like that. Then Ronan will do a version, and then we had a couple of different writers. Lastly, I think Tyrone was doing some dialogue pass, you know, a couple of people do dialogue passes and give it a slightly more street feel to it. And then, yes, on the day, there would be a kind of, you know, with the actors would bring another layer. So they read pretty good. They don't read like sort of, you know, a million miles away. Yeah, things develop and change as we go. And, you know, yeah.
Cool. Obviously, famously, Top Boy had an interesting journey from the fact that it was on Channel 4 and then later came back on Netflix. And I apologize in advance. There's always one question I have to ask every guest. And this one is yours, Charles. How did you first get contacted by Drake about making more Top Boy?
Well, as you mentioned, Channel 4, we were about to do a third series. They put it into turnaround. And at the time, it kind of, if you dumb it down, it's sort of, it's a black gang show on one level. Very soon, I mean, it's not, but it sort of, in terms of market sell, and nobody would touch it then. So, and then about 5-6 years later, sorry, it's a long answer to your question, but there is an answer here. 5 or 6 years later, suddenly the sort of things had changed and the world had opened up. And it felt like a show like that, people were knocking the doors on. So we were sort of sniffing around maybe, and there were early talks with Vice and, you know, maybe we could bring Top Boy back. Coincidentally, at the same time, Drake had discovered Top Boy, the Channel 4 version, I think on YouTube when he's recording, and loved it. It resonated a lot for him with areas and people he knew growing up in Toronto, which has a big Jamaican community there and kind of a sense of streets. And he just kind of connected with it. I think he'd reached out through Ashley and then lawyers got in touch. And it was a very complicated process, bizarrely. It's all about people not talking to each other, where they were sort of all through lawyers. It felt like, or understanding it, sort of there was a miscommunication about thinking that they were looking to, you know, remake it in America. And we were like, you know, I mean, there wasn't much upside and a lot of downside in terms of losing the brand. And then when we started to feel ourselves, maybe we can have a go at a time with Vice, so we're talking about it. It suddenly just seemed, why don't we chat directly? And anyway, I can't remember how we got put in touch with Future, who's his producing partner. And then it kind of started from there. I said, no, we don't want to remake it. We want to see more Top Boy. And we're like, well, so do we. Well, then let's do it together. No brainer. And then it was about working out who we wanted to work with in terms of streamers and broadcasters. I remember meeting Drake about it. You know, his comment, which really resonated, was like, you know, he's obviously wonderfully effusive about the show, excited to be there, but he said, you know, I can be the gasoline to your fire. You know, what you do is great, and my job is to spread the word. That's what I can do for you. And so he said, great, you got to, you know, come to the States and we'll go and see Netflix and pitch. And yeah, I remember saying rather naively to Future and Drake, you know, you don't need to say much, just be in the room and we'll do the talking. You don't need to say anything. And, you know, Drake starts talking and doesn't stop for an hour, just talking about the world and the field. The meeting ended. Nobody else said anything. And they said, we're doing it. So it was all down to him in a way. Yeah.
Very cool. Thank you for humoring me with that one, Charles. There's always one I have to ask. You mentioned all the people involved there, people not talking to each other. And for anyone who hasn't worked on a film set, it can be pretty crazy with the people involved. And as a producer, you have to operate, in your own words, as a person of trust. Is it mentally tough to be that guy, girl in the middle of all these things?
No, I mean, I think it's, I mean, maybe it is, but it's, to be honest, it's why I produce. It's what I love. You know, people ask about producing, in terms of describe it, you know, they don't know the industry. The way I've always described it, which excites me and gets me out of bed in the morning, is that, you know, it feels like there is, because so much money is at stake and it's a sort of strange art form, craft form, entertainment business thing. And you've got two different worlds, a kind of world of artists, you know, writers, cinematographers, musicians, actors. And then on the other side, you've got, you know, banks, finance, insurance, sales, bottom lines, huge stuff. And these two worlds feel totally opposing in terms of their objectives and their attitudes. And I just don't think they communicate so well together. And I think the job of a producer is to sit in the middle and be able to balance both sources and have the trust of both the artistic community and also, you know, financiers. So it's kind of, which I just think, you know, half the day, one might be in a writer's room or in a grade or in a recording studio, and then the other half the day dealing with raising money, banks, litigation, lawyers, and sales. So I just think it's such an exciting world to be in that middle. It probably is stressful, but you know, maybe I like the stress of it. That's kind of the, that's what I think producing is about, you know, and sort of, yeah.
It sounds like you ride the wave of it well. And as a corny segue, speaking of trust and water, as a producer, you're the guy who's signing lots of things when you're putting Jude Law and your cast in a submarine on Black Sea. Could you talk about the process of working with water like that? I'm interested in movies like that, like The Abyss and things where it seems very dangerous at times to film, and some of that's on your shoulders, I guess, the pressure of that.
Yes. I mean, yeah, Black Sea, interesting journey, that one. Yeah, I suppose the pressure is, I mean, you know, it's totally safe. It's more logistics. How does one pull it off in a way? I mean, you know, we're surrounded by health and safety experts and wonderful stunt technicians. So in terms of, you know, worrying about, is it safe? One doesn't on a day-to-day basis worry about that. It's logistics, how to pull it off and be good. I mean, Black Sea was an unusual one. It was going to be a single TV movie, Dennis Kelly wrote. We were going to do it for Channel 4 as a single movie with Kevin and a sort of really have a go, really exciting B movie. And the script was so good, it kind of grew and then became something else. But we heard that there was this submarine, this Russian submarine sitting in the River Medway near Rochester. And apparently somebody had bought it. And when the Soviet was breaking up, they were selling some submarines. They stripped them of all the batteries and the comms. And they were selling these submarines. And somebody thought it would be great to bring as a sort of tourist attraction, a bit like the Bismarck, into the River Thames. This is how the story is told to me. And they brought it, and it was being transported by tug ship across to the UK, and it sank. And Russia said, they said, okay, well, there's another one. They brought another one. Cut long story short, they got it to the River Thames, and then they couldn't get permission from the Thames Water Authority or whatever. So it sort of was this unloved thing sitting. They put it to the River Medway, and it's just sitting. You can see it now as you get trained there. It's just sitting, this whole Russian submarine just sitting there listing. And they tried to kind of had dinner parties on it, trying to find a way to use it. And anyway, we saw it and just thought that's like perfect. So that was quite complicated because we had to sort of pump it out slightly, get it so it was stable. And then it was a little bit from the shore. We had to have loads of boats going back and forward, build rafts around it. So we used that for a lot of it and then replicated for the action stuff. We rebuilt the interior in Pinewood, so and used the water tank a bit there. So yeah, that was fun, sort of in terms of putting all those bits together. The water tank in Pinewood is great, and having a big old submarine on rocker with people splashing stuff all over the place. Yeah,
I love that answer. That was great. Thank you very much, Charles. Now, before we wrap up on Red Carpet Rookies, I normally do a quick fire at the end, but just one quick question before that. I wondered, do you have any producing heroes or general heroes?
Well, I would say probably David Putnam. The Mission, The Killing Fields, and so many others, certainly of my era growing up. And I think I must say it was like a real, I used to go to all his talks and he was absolutely, and read all those books where, you know, when he was at Goldcrest, you know, My Indecision Is Final, and all those books where he featured his story. And he was absolutely my hero. And then when we did Last King of Scotland, it was a real highlight for me that the film won some BAFTAs, including for myself, and, you know, quite rightly, Kevin's film was, you know, everyone was raving about it at the time. And then I got a message, you know, about 3 weeks later after the BAFTAs from the House of Lords saying, today Putnam would like to see you and invites you for lunch. And, you know, you got to wear a tie and a suit. And it was great. It finally felt in a way like, you know, I'd arrived, you know, I sort of like, and I'd never met him, but I you know, came and, yeah, it's great. Just had a, you know, it was great actually. And but it was a big moment for me in my journey from starting out as a runner and turning up. I remember going to the, you know, NFT and listening to his talks. You know, he used to do these kind of things with Michael Winner and stuff and bat things around. And that was big highlight. It felt like, you know, wow, I'm here ish.
So producers can wear suits. You were right to wear that to that art school interview.
Yeah, to the House of Lords, I did have to. I had to for there. So yeah, there is a place for it. Just not an art college, you know.
Awesome. So, yeah. Now, as I mentioned, to wrap up, Charles, on Red Carpet Rookies, I do a little quick fire questionnaire, which is my own ode to In the Actors Studio. So if you just think of what comes into your head, the first question is, what is one of the best pieces of advice you've ever been given?
Well, I think I mentioned my sales background before, and I think just that it sounds very corny, but every rejection, every no is kind of one step closer to a yes. And, you know, just if I look back at sort of, you know, in hindsight of my life, and I sort of just, and I just when I gave up with a film, a project, chasing an actor, a director, or whatever it might be, and actually one more call and just around the corner was a yes, I'd be kicking myself, you know, if only I'd stuck in there. So, and a lot of times, you know, stories of films, yeah. So I'm not giving up, and that sense of just being able to try and ride rejection and not feel it too personally, and which there's a lot of in this game. And you know, and just look at it as like, okay, we're closer to the yes now, you know.
Awesome. Number two, do you have a favorite film?
An easy favorite is probably Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Nice. Just for its kind of romance, love of it, and its style and feel. I would say the film that made probably the most impression on me, it's not my favorite film necessarily, I like it, but it's not up there, is The Piano, Jane Campion's The Piano, namely because I one of the first years I was in Cannes working as a runner, I think for the BFI stand, I was manning the stand, and I managed to get a ticket for the sort of black tie gala launch premiere of it, and seeing a film showing Cannes in that environment, this huge cinema, it's like a homage to cinema. It is like the Mecca. It's the greatest place to see a movie, and the audience, and then afterwards a 10-minute standing ovation, and Jane Campion standing there with the cast in the middle of it all, and just the you know, you went, wow, this is, you know. So in terms of the power of cinema, and I'm reminded, you know, when I go back to Cannes, you know, we watch film on streamers left, right and center and all the rest and different formats. Those moments are, wow, that blew me away in terms of its momentous impression on me.
I love that answer. That was really great. Number three, what gives you a reason to get out of bed every day for a day of producing?
I think the excitement of putting a deal together. I don't mean necessarily money, but just like a deal as in finding the right concoction, you know, finding an idea, mixing it with a writer, connecting it with a director, ultimately an actor and some financiers, and just cooking it all up. And, you know, it's all possible. The ingredients are all there. And a lot of time you're throwing and missing, and just when you line it up and it cooks and it takes off, and wow, and that can become something. So I think that aspect of creating, of in terms of, you know, the DNA of the people and the ingredients and the mix and who's right and how it all works. Yeah.
Cool. Number four, what job would you do in the industry if you weren't doing yours?
I think that's easy. And it's a job I saw early on. I wouldn't change it now, but I would be the director of photography. I mean, I just think it's such a beautiful job. You don't have any of the stress of kind of like a director or a producer putting a film together and worrying about editing it and selling it. You just turn up when everything's done, the money's there, the actors are in place, you're flown in about 3 or 4 weeks before, you are treated like the single most important person on set, probably. The actors are fawning over you. Please shoot me in a nice way. I'm better on this side. Everyone loves you. They're a bit like the sort of flyboys, I always remember, you know, sort of in the RAF or something. And, you know, and yet they're pure artists, you know, as Vittorio Storaro said, you know, they're kind of, you know, they're painting with light, you know, that it's just what they do is phenomenal. Yeah. So I think that that's got to be a, you know, a lot of stress there. You know, you get it wrong, you know, not good. But I think that's got to be up there, yeah.
Love that answer. Number five, what is a book, ideally career-focused, but it really doesn't have to be, that everyone should read?
I think the easy one, William Goldman, Adventures in the Screen Trade. Just fun, you know, it's just easy. It gives a good, I mean, there are lots of them like that, but that's the sort of the Bible of the anecdotal, you know, what's it like kind of movies, yeah, what's movies like.
Of course. And finally, if you won an Oscar, who would you thank?
I think I would thank... my first partner, Polly Tapson, who sadly, you know, passed away, who was a, you know, hugely influential piece for me. And also my father, who, you know, those early days, I remember, you know, they took a while to get there, me and my dad. But those early days, I was trying to get a job as a runner. And I remember getting my first days running in Jacob Street Studios, working for free on a commercial, you know, didn't expect to be paid or anything, and had to be there at sort of 5 a.m. and my dad getting up and driving me. You know, he was, when it counted, he was there, you know. So, yeah, I thank him.
Amazing to go, yeah, in a circle there, all the way back to your dad at the beginning. Thank you very much for your time today, Charles. Thank you for listening to another episode of Red Carpet Rookies. To help us grow and be able to interview more amazing film and TV professionals, please do subscribe and drop us a rating on the Apple Podcast Store on your iPhone or online if you're an Android user. If you're interested in regular updates, the best thing you can do is to join our mailing list at redcarpetrookies.com, or alternatively, find us on Instagram at redcarpetrookies or Twitter at rcrookiespod. I also tweet regularly about my own learnings in the business at Mike F. Battle on Twitter, so please do come and say hi. Thank you again for listening. We'll see you next time.